Action Park Media.
Let's get a mic check here. 1, 2, 1, 2, episode 86. No gruffs given. If you were married to me, you would kill me in my sleep. Annie Kinsella, a.k.a. Amy Madigan. Episode 86, no gruffs given. So, holy shit. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. All right. Obviously, another day, another dollar. Another day, another dollop. Another dollop of shit. Let's take a side order of shit for those pancakes, sir. Let me start with this Naomi Osaka drama. I'm a father, okay? I'm also a former professional athlete, all right? I'm very compassionate for our children, okay? I want our children to always be in safe environments, to be confident, to be able to work hard, play hard, have fun, all that stuff, okay? So, but I have to separate that from the conversation that I want to have right now about Naomi Osaka, because she's a professional tennis player. And when you're a professional athlete, you have some things that you have to do that you don't want to do, like, you know, maybe run on a treadmill or deal with the media. That is an absolute obligation. As a professional athlete, when you decide, okay, I'm no longer going to be an amateur, I'm going to be a professional, I'm going to get paid to play, you then have to answer questions from the media. It's actually, it's a law. It's a rule, not a law, but as part of you being in the organization to be able to make money, to get paid, to get prize money, you have to deal with the media. So I didn't touch the whole thing when she had a meltdown, I don't know, a month ago or 2 months ago or whatever it was. All right. I stayed away from it. But this fucking stunt that she just pulled in Cincinnati, all right. Now I have to say something, because, and the reason that I'm saying it is because the writer is getting dragged through the fucking mud. You know, Paul Daugherty of the Cincinnati Inquirer. So Paul's getting, his reputation's getting tarnished. People are attacking Paul because of the question that he asked. So first of all, this girl, this young woman is so fragile, okay? I can't believe that she has the ability to even go out on the tennis court and play. I've never seen somebody as fragile as she is. I mean, and as a parent, that's where I'm saying, like, okay, where is her team? I mean, I know where her agent is. Her agent's fucking going on the record trying to ruin the reporter, right? He says, the insinuation that Naomi owes her off-court success to the media is a myth. Don't be so self-indulgent. The bully at the Cincinnati Inquirer is the epitome of why player media relations are so fraught right now. Everyone on that Zoom will agree that his tone was all wrong and his sole purpose was to intimidate. Really appalling behavior. Oh my God. First of all, it's on a fucking Zoom. Okay. He basically asked her, Naomi, you've said numerous times that you really dislike the media. What I want to know is, how do you handle and balance your tennis life via the media and all the other personal stuff that you're interested in that you are focused on bringing awareness to? Like, for example, she's donating her prize money in this tournament to Haiti because Haiti was just hit with an earthquake. So let me simplify that. Basically, she has a platform because she's a professional tennis player. She uses that platform for personal reasons at times. The only reason she has that platform is because there's media and they ask her questions. All right. Again, as a professional athlete, you don't get to fucking opt out of the media. Not to mention they're doing it by Zoom and her agent says that this guy was intimidating. I mean, who isn't intimidating now in this woke fucking world that we live in? Maybe Stewart, her agent, shouldn't have put his fucking client in a situation where she was going to have a meltdown again. Maybe he should fuck an agent instead of worrying about the questions that she's going to get asked. This is a fucking train wreck. This is a complete train wreck. Naomi Osaka, in this same press conference, said that she'd like to see players have the ability to have sick days from press conferences. Ha! Sick days. She's trying to wrap her head around the fact that the media like to talk to athletes as fast as they possibly can after the match or the game is over. Yeah, no shit. That's called fucking sports. That's called being a professional athlete 101. Learning how to deal with the media after you've played a bad game or you just cost your team the season. I mean, this is what our fucking youth, this is like a role model for our children right now. The children that want to be excellent and maybe make something of themselves someday, be a professional athlete. Fuck me. Give me a fucking break. Give me a break. This is embarrassing. A sick day. You get one sick day a season. Okay. So I'm going to play a game. All right. It's game 7, Stanley Cup Finals. And I score on my own net. I didn't use my sick day all season long, playoffs. I'm going to use my sick day today. I'm not going to talk to the media. I'm just going to go home. Ha ha. Are you fucking kidding me? Give me a fucking break. Episode 86, no gruffs given. All right. Manscaped makes a trimmer. Okay. If you're not aware of the pubic hair maintenance space, it's revolutionary. All right. Not only does it help you look good and feel good, but it also helps you actually look better than you would, look thinner. It's not a wives tale. I mean, it is a fact. If you manicure yourself personally, when you look at yourself in the mirror or when people see you, you look leaner, you look tighter, you just look like you have your shit together. So Manscaped's new Lawnmower 4.0, kick your pubes to the next planet with the Lawnmower 4.0. It's a lawnmower for your pubes. You're going to go to manscaped.com. I'm giving you 20% off, free shipping. That's manscaped.com, 20% off, free shipping. They also have the weed whacker, all right, which is a nose, ear, and hair trimmer using their proprietary skin-safe technology, of course. Episode 86, no gruffs given. That's manscaped.com. Use the promo code Sean. Episode 86, no gruffs given. Oh, you know what? While we're on it, okay, Nutrafol. Guys, losing your hair is probably the worst thing that I think could ever happen, right? You know, there's other worse things. Getting cancer is a terrible thing. But losing your hair for a man it's debilitating, all right? You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support yourself and your future by going to Nutrafol.com, entering the promo code Sean. I'm going to give you $15 off your first month's subscription. This is their best offer anywhere, and it's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. Nutrafol.com, promo code Sean, okay? When it comes to thinning hair, you no longer have to choose between natural remedies. There's a holistic solution for men that promotes both healthier hair and whole body wellness without drugs or prescriptions. So sounds pretty good, right? We're going to give you a natural option to kickstart that hair growth. And the other, you know, there's other things that you can do that are expensive, that don't work. Nutrafol is clinically shown to improve hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage without compromise. 21 potent natural ingredients support sex drive, better sleep, and less stress. All right. Propecia is a competitor, completely kills your sex drive. I have tried it, and that is a fact, all right? So I wish Nutrafol was around when I was looking to get some hair growth back, because after 12 years, well, no, I don't know, 20 years playing hockey, I had a helmet head, and it was chipping away at my hairline. Now I got a fucking, I got a full nest up top. So we all know how debilitating hair loss is. Okay. Nutrafol, this is their first ad read with me. I'd like to have a nice relationship with them. Guys, we're on the Look Good, Feel Good program. Okay. Your hair is like a handshake. It's like a fucking visual handshake. It's the first thing everyone sees, probably before your eyes. If you're getting a little thin and you want to address it, I think you give Nutrafol a shot. You're going to go to Nutrafol.com, enter the promo code Sean, episode 86, no gruffs given. So I got a couple of things to play, all right? Very important. Oh, by the way, two unbelievable interviews, okay? Really, really fantastic interviews. I'm excited. I interviewed Dwyer Brown. Dwyer Brown plays Ray Kinsella in Field of Dreams. They just had the Field of Dreams game with Major League Baseball. I have an unbelievable conversation with Ray about acting, about movies, about the world. It's just fantastic. And then we slide over to a very important conversation. A very important conversation with a gal by the name of Jen Watson. Jen is from Denver. She has had her life flipped fucking upside down. All right. You're going to hear this interview. If anyone knows any appeals attorneys in Denver, Colorado, send me a message. So we got two fantastic interviews in episode 86. I got a couple of videos that I want to play. That I think you need to hear. All right. Because the world is turned upside down. I mean, we know what just happened this weekend with Afghanistan. Our president is at Camp David. He resumed his vacation. Jen Psaki, she's on vacation. I just want us all to be the best that we can be. Really. I want us firing on all cylinders. Now, to do that, you also have to eat well. All right. So we're coming back to my favorite, HelloFresh. You remember, I'm going to give you how many? 14 free meals. You're going to start with 14 free meals. Right out of the gates, you're going to go to HelloFresh.com/14Sean. Use the code 14Sean for up to 14 free meals. That's also including free shipping. I use HelloFresh when you got kids, you got a lot going on, and we need to minimize our stress. We need to make everything as effective as possible. We got to maximize our time and our output. That is how you strive so that we all collectively are on the Look Good, Feel Good program. We want to fucking fire on all cylinders. Be the best that you can be. It's like the goddamn Marines or the Army. So I'm telling you, I'm giving you value as usual. Now to execute on that value, you're going to go to HelloFresh.com/14Sean. Use the promo code 14Sean. That's 14 free meals. All right. Episode 86, no gruffs given. Let's start with this first video. Again, let me just be very clear. Okay. I'm not political. I can't even vote. But I'll tell you what, we're in a heap of trouble right now. And I saw this speech. And I thought to myself, you know what? This would have been the speech that hopefully our president would have gave. But we didn't receive that. So let's run it. I want you to hear it.
My fellow Americans, our brave men and women in Afghanistan are under attack. The policy of America, though, is to never leave our citizens and those who have come to our aid behind. The moment I heard of the attack on our people in Kabul, I got on the phone with the local air command. I ordered as many aircraft in the air as we could sustain. Their orders were simple: kill any confirmed militants attempting to seize further ground against the Afghan army or coalition establishments. I had my Joint Chiefs of Staff activate all special forces within 1,000 miles of Kabul. The closest team of Navy SEALs was on site in less than 3 hours to take up sniper positions on every rooftop available. The commanding officer of the USS Ronald Reagan immediately launched fighter jets from the deck just over 400 miles from Kabul. They were on site in 26 minutes. The DASC, our air command, initiated a revolving wing of KC-10 mid-air refueling platforms, and our Predator drones were on site to maintain constant air coverage. I told them if they have to land in Iran and steal the oil right from the Ayatollah himself, I don't care. America will pay any price right now to keep our planes in the air and the pressure on the enemy. Our AC-130 gunships have been on station since the first threat was identified and are reloading munitions as we speak. I have authorized the movement of an additional carrier battle group to the Arabian Sea. Our fleet of C-17s out of Ramstein, Germany, amounting to almost half of the 223 possessed by the U.S. military, are already on the ground in Kabul. They brought with them full loads of Marines and Army infantry. Those planes are currently returning 400 people at a time to a safe location. Our non-combat personnel are being evacuated first, followed by our interpreters and their families. The military will hold the airfield and the city for the foreseeable future. To the Taliban, the United States is prepared to exhaust our entire armory to defend this city. Stand down, or I'll turn the surrounding area and your caves into a parking lot. Do not interfere with our mission, our evacuations, and certainly do not fire another shot at my fellow Americans. Each bullet will be met with bombs, lots of them. When you are ready to come to the table and have a civil conversation, America is ready, willing, and able. But until then, you will be treated as an enemy of the United States. And if you desire, we can and will promptly arrange your consultation with Allah. Now, this is the speech our president should have given days ago.
There we go. Now, I'm not sure if you've seen the speech that President Biden gave, but he blamed a lot of people. He blamed a lot of people outside of himself and his administration. Now, I'm not going to get into the minutia of this thing, all right? What I will address is the fact that we still have Americans there. And before Biden went to Camp David, he said there will absolutely be no situation where Americans will be getting airlifted off the top of the embassy. Not only did that happen, but they were also burning documents. What is happening? What is happening in our countries? Episode 86, No Gruffs Given. Do you own or rent your home? Well, sure you do. And I bet it can be hard. Well, you know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing too, because you already had so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. Episode 86, No Gruffs Given. And you know what? There's one more video that I need to play, because it just got me thinking. And again, if we can't think out loud, if we can't ask questions, if we can't desire a safe country where people are treated equally and fairly, and we're all trying to fucking again fire on all cylinders, be the best that we can be, then, well, I don't know. But I want to play this.
Joe Biden went on television today, this afternoon, and talked to the country about Afghanistan. He said, among other things, that we had no choice but to leave. And on that question, he is right. The United States should have left Afghanistan 19 years ago when it became obvious that Osama bin Laden wasn't there and had fled to Pakistan. There was no reason to stay in the country. And the longer we remained, the worse it was always going to be. The question is, and the relevant question today, is how exactly do you get out? Just because something is necessary doesn't mean you get to ignore the details of it. If you learned you needed an emergency appendectomy, would it matter to you who performed the operation, a surgeon with a scalpel or a drunk guy with a pocket knife? Yes, it would matter to you. But it didn't matter to Joe Biden, apparently. He barely mentioned the withdrawal today. Biden did the necessary thing in the ugliest possible way. If you've been watching television during the day, you've probably seen this footage. It's terrified men in sandals clinging to the side of a C-17 as it attempts to leave Afghanistan. And this is the iconic photo of the moment. It's the final humiliating scene of the American occupation of Afghanistan. That means that after 20 years and trillions of dollars, our leaders couldn't manage to pull off an orderly retreat. They couldn't even secure a single runway. And that's the main lesson of the fall of Kabul. We are led by buffoons. They have no idea what they're doing. We know that now. They're imposters. Everything they touch turns to chaos, not just there, but here. These are the people who run the Amtrak station in Midtown Manhattan, the one that's filled with drug addicts. They're the people in charge of the power grid in the state of California. They have no useful skills. And yet somehow these same people assured us they were going to turn Stone Age Afghanistan into modern Belgium. Remembering it now is bitter and hilarious. At this point, our leaders are so discredited, they're running out of ways to criticize the Taliban. Is the Biden administration really going to attack the new government of Afghanistan for forcing women to cover their faces? Are American diplomats actually going to lecture Taliban leaders about toppling statues? Probably not going to happen. That's how much credibility our leaders have lost, how much moral authority they have squandered in the past 20 years. But most of what they've lost is their self-awareness. They have none. Until just this weekend, for example, they had no idea how badly they were failing in Afghanistan. Here's John Kirby, the Pentagon, explaining that, calm down, America. Everything in Kabul is under control. Keep in mind, we have not edited this tape, and it's not from last year. This is 3 days ago.
Kabul is not right now in an imminent threat environment.
Oh, good job, John Kirby. Think he'll keep his job? Of course he'll keep his job. A man who's willing to defend pregnant fighter pilots can work in Washington forever. And so can Mark Milley at the Joint Chiefs and the rest of the woke clowns at the Pentagon. Generals who are much more worried about white rage in West Virginia than they are about our enemies abroad. When was the last time these guys won a war? Seriously, they hate it when you ask that question. Nothing bothers them more. But what's the answer? When was that? And while we're at it, how about the intel agencies? Their job is very specific. Give policymakers some rough sense of what's going to happen in the world, especially on the big questions, so they can make wise decisions. How's the intel world doing on that? Let's see. The collapse of the Soviet Union, 9/11, the fall of Kabul, not small things, major history-changing events. They missed all of those completely. They had no idea. So why are they still there? Well, because someone's got to read your text messages, got to make sure you're not making fun of trans people or anything like that. And then there's the Biden administration overseeing all of it, the group led by the senile credit card shill from Delaware and staffed by power-hungry non-entities who believe they're God. Hubris, that doesn't describe the vibe at the current White House. It's much more grandiose than that, and there's far less justification for it. Here's our sitting national security advisor, for example. He is 44 years old. As far as we can tell, he has never had an actual job. Outside of school, he has no accomplishments whatsoever. Watch this highly respected Rhodes Scholar explain that, in fact, everything you're seeing on TV from Afghanistan is a victory.
How do you explain getting this so wrong?
Well, first, Savannah, to be fair, the helicopter has been the mode of transport from our embassy to the airport for the last 20 years.
But you know the larger point. It's not the helicopter.
That is how we move
it's not
people
the mechanism.
Back and forth. So
no, no, it's the last. It's not the mechanism. It's the last minute scramble. You know that. It's the last minute scramble when the assurances from the president himself were this was not what we were going to see.
The reason that there are U.S. forces at the airport, effectuating a successful drawdown of our embassy, securing the airport to be able to get other people out, is because the president pre-positioned those forces, thousands of them, in the Gulf so they could be moved in rapidly in the event that there was a rapid collapse.
Oh. So they're effectuating a successful drawdown of our embassy. So that's what we call it when you burn your files and flee in a helicopter from approaching gunfire. You're just effectuating another successful drawdown. Woohoo! We could go on. We could torture you with the failures and the details. We haven't even mentioned our, quote, Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, a man so mediocre you gasp when you hear him speak. Can you really be that dumb and run the Department of State? Yeah, you can. And the last several decades of American foreign policy prove that you can't. Afghanistan is not the first country our leaders have left worse than they found it. The list of those countries is long, and sadly, it's growing. Part of the reason is that for decades, left-wing academics in the U.S. have used the developing world as a laboratory to test their theories about how societies ought to be ordered but aren't. Over time, they've constructed a parallel government of NGOs that work alongside our Pentagon and our State Department, as well as with the United Nations, to impose radical social engineering projects on the world's poorest people who have no say in the matter. Over the past 20 years, for example, Congress has allocated close to $1 billion to export academic feminism to Afghanistan. Where'd that money go? Well, it went to programs like a 2-year master's degree in gender and women's studies offered at Kabul University, something Afghans apparently never knew they needed. Another U.S. government effort, meanwhile, funded, quote, activities that educate and engage Afghan men and boys to challenge gender stereotypes. Right. They weren't doing that enough. And of course, always and everywhere, our leaders enforced the most American of all cultural exports, affirmative action. American-funded gender advisors demanded that women compromise at least 10% of the Afghan National Army and a still larger proportion of that country's political leadership. Thanks to American-imposed gender quotas, dozens of women ultimately were installed as representatives in Afghan's parliament. How'd that work? Well, the whole thing was a sham, as always. In fact, many of these new female legislators had never been to the provinces they claimed to represent. Almost nobody in Afghanistan liked any of this, by the way, and why would they? As one USAID official conceded in a classified report, quote, focusing on gender made things more unstable because it caused revolts. It caused revolts. But officials kept doing it. They kept pushing radical gender politics anyway because they could, because they were in charge of these Stone Age people they were going to educate. This is the face of the late American empire, gender studies seminars at gunpoint. This is not like other empires. Unlike other empires, ours does not operate for our benefit. America toppled Saddam but took no oil. Remember that? Instead, the entire point of our imperial project is to give meaning to the empty lives of the neoliberal bureaucrats who administer it and then enrich the contractors who work for them, who are enriched, you'll be happy to know. What role do the rest of us play in this? None. We just pay for it. Yesterday, to underscore that point, the Biden administration told us that American citizens would not be given priority in the evacuation from Kabul. So our government's official position is that American lives are not more valuable than the lives of foreigners. But you already knew that because you've seen our southern border. The people who made the Afghan occupation possible would like to see a lot more of our southern border, much more unrestrained immigration to the U.S. Bring in the refugees, they're screaming tonight. That's the only lesson they're taking from this debacle. Quote, America must not stand idly by, Mitt Romney tweeted today. The president must urgently rush to defend, rescue, and give and expand asylum. There is no time to spare. There's lots of time to spare as Americans die of fentanyl ODs and millions of foreign nationals whose identities we can't confirm move here. But when it comes to bringing Afghans to our country, there's no time to spare. And Liz Cheney firmly agrees with that. So does her friend Bill Kristol and Nancy Pelosi and Victoria Nuland at the State Department and so many more just like them. These are the architects of the disaster we are watching unfold on television. They should be groveling for our forgiveness, but they're not. Why? Because contrition requires decency. There's no chance. So we're getting it. And if history is any guide, and it's always a guide, we will see many refugees from Afghanistan resettle in our country in coming months, probably in your neighborhood. And over the next decade, that number may swell to the millions. So first we invade, and then we're invaded. It is always the same. We'll be spending a lot more time on that subject in coming weeks because it matters. But first, since Kabul has just fallen, it might be worth asking the most obvious question of all. Why did the Taliban win? How did the 6th century triumph over the 21st century? There are indications that the single most notorious and reviled government in the world, primitive people famous for their brutality, rigidity, and humorlessness, are more popular in parts of Afghanistan than they were when we expelled the mullahs from Kandahar 20 years ago. They don't seem to be less popular. So how did that happen? What's the answer? We ought to pause to think about that. Let's not just blow past it like it was an act of God. It's not. What is the answer? Well, countries are very complicated, all of them, so there are likely many answers. But one of those answers may be that the population of Afghanistan has firmly rejected what our leaders were selling it over 20 years. It turns out that the people of Afghanistan don't actually want gender studies symposia. They didn't actually buy the idea that men can become pregnant. They thought that was ridiculous. They don't hate their own masculinity. They don't think it's toxic. They like the patriarchy. Some of their women like it, too. So now they're getting it all back. So maybe it's possible that we failed in Afghanistan because the entire neoliberal program is grotesque. It's a joke. It's contrary to human nature. It answers none of our deepest human desires. It is merely a performance staged for the performer. It's not even supposed to improve your life. It's ridiculous. And ideas that ridiculous can only be imposed by force, only with armed men at gunpoint. The moment these ideas are not mandatory, the second the troops withdraw, in fact, people tend to revert to the lives that they prefer to live. That may be the real lesson of Afghanistan. Let's hope our leader.
There's some things that I don't agree with in that Tucker Carlson monologue. And, you know, that's okay. You know, I don't agree with him, his reference to now we're being invaded. If we need to get people out of Afghanistan, Afghanis that helped us Americans survive a war, then we need to do that. And I don't know what the number is. I don't. And the other thing, this masculinity, the toxic masculinity, all right, I don't think anyone, and I hope to God that the Afghan people aren't becoming used to the Taliban's masculinity. You can't even call it that, but their complete lack of regard for human rights and more particular women's rights. So I don't agree with a couple of those things, but all in all, a lot of the things he was saying, it makes sense. Episode 86, no gruff given. Pretty Litter's back for another week. I got to tell you, I haven't been updated on whether or not they have their supply chain moving, but they're here. So with that being said, Pretty Litter is kitty litter reinvented. It's unlike traditional litter. Pretty Litter super light crystals. They trap odor and they release moisture, resulting in dry, low maintenance litter that doesn't smell. Again, if you have a cat, you want litter that doesn't smell. God, that's like having a toilet wide open. Nobody wants that. That's why you don't have your toilet in the middle of the living room. Pretty Litter is made to be safe for your cat and you. It's made from ultra absorbent minerals and it's virtually dust free. It arrives at your door in a small, lightweight bag that lasts an entire month. You're going to go to prettylitter.com, use the promo code Sean for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code Sean for 20% off, prettylitter.com. Promo code Sean, episode 86, no gruffs given. All right, so we're going to go to my interview with Dwyer, and then we're going to roll that into my interview with Jen. Episode 86, no gruffs given. Mr. Dwyer Brown.
This is he.
How are you? It's Sean Avery calling.
Hey, Sean. Well, things are going good. Kind of settling down after a crazy week, but going well.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, it popped out of nowhere. Like, I feel like they didn't do a ton of press prepping it beforehand because I missed it. But then obviously the next day you woke up and you saw all the all the press. It was dominating everything.
Yeah, I agree. I think they might have been a little concerned after last year's game had to be canceled at the last minute.
Right.
I think they kind of left it right to the last minute with this kind of Delta surge that maybe it wasn't going to happen again. So
yeah, because the Yankees certainly have had they've had a bunch of players go down in the last couple of weeks. So
yeah,
you might be right about that. When was the last time you were at the field?
Previous to this, I guess it was just less than a month ago. I ended up I bought a building in Dyersville that was kind of ready to be demolished. This really cool old building from 1860 that the roof had gotten destroyed 5 years ago and has just been kind of getting in worse and worse shape. And I decided to fix it up and try to, you know, kind of revitalize the community a little bit there in Dyersville.
How far do you live near there? Or is this something you have to commute there?
Yeah, I live in Southern California. So it's been, you know, schlepping back and forth.
Wow. Wow. When you originally, way back when you filmed the film, was all the interior stuff in the house, was that done on a soundstage or was that done on a house, like on location somewhere?
A good portion of it was done in the house. I think they created a bedroom, I think down in Dubuque to shoot some of the scenes between Amy and Kevin. And, you know, there were various other sets. You know, they created the Boston in Dubuque, you know, Chisholm, Minnesota was in Galena, which is just across the border into Illinois. Fenway was actually in Fenway.
Wow.
But yeah, wow. It was they were pretty enterprising with kind of finding locations because the budget was considered small for that era.
What's the history of the property? So like, I didn't know that the house that's on the property, they actually shot the interiors there.
There's a pretty storied history. The Lansing family has owned that farmhouse for, over 100 years. Don Lansing was the son who sort of lived there when we were shooting the movie.
Yep.
But I don't know, some 60 years ago, they sold a couple hundred acres to Al Ameskamp, who lived next door. Well, when they came to shoot the movie and decided to place the field where they placed it, left and center field ended up being on Al Ameskamp's property.
Wow.
So they had to, you know, pay both of them to rent, you know, the space to put the field in. And when the movie was done shooting in 88, Al just plowed in left and center field and, you know, put corn back in it. But Don Lansing just had this premonition that he should keep the field there for a year, you know, and indeed he did that. And within months of the release of the movie, the first unexpected visitor arrived on his way to driving from New York to San Francisco and talked to Dan. And then of course it was just, just kind of was a trickle that turned into, an absolute tidal wave of visitors that, you know, millions of people have been there over the intervening decades.
Do you remember where you were when you read the script for the first time?
Well, what's interesting is I had a friend from high school who was a creative writing major, and he gave me a copy of the book Shoeless Joe when I was in college still. And it's a great book. I just loved it. So when the audition came down the pike for this, you know, tiny little baseball movie called Shoeless Joe, I was just so excited to be a part of it. You know, it's always more interesting to know your material and love it before you even read the script. And Phil obviously did a great job with the script, and in many ways that I didn't even realize until years later, the kind of, because the book and the film are quite different. In the book, Ray has an identical twin brother. There's a character called the oldest living Chicago Cub. There's a lot of things that, you know, don't even get touched upon in the screenplay, but are, you know, make for a very interesting novella.
So like back then, you know, now everything auditions, like the idea of going in to see a casting director is, that's sort of obsolete now. Where did you audition for this?
It was just at a casting office, as I recall, on Cahuenga Boulevard in West LA. It's been so long since I lived in LA, but it was just an office they had hired. I think Marjorie Simkin was the casting director, and I don't think that those were her offices. I think that was just they were close enough to Universal to warrant renting them. And that was many years ago.
Do you remember, like, when you walked out of the room, how did you feel? Did you think?
I had vague recollections of the audition. I ended up, when I wrote my book, If You Build It, I had to research a bunch of this stuff because my memory was foggy. And you know, there was a lot of it that, as an actor, you're not privy to. You know,
right.
I didn't realize how many people had auditioned for the part until I looked at the casting records, which Marjorie had.
Wow, you went back and so you interviewed Marjorie and sort of just went through the whole thing?
Yeah, I really did. And
wow.
all her casting records are at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Library.
Come on.
So it was very interesting. When I was researching the book, I looked through the list of guys coming in, many of whom I'd auditioned for many times, you know, just familiar names that, you know, I dreaded because they would always beat me out for the part. But sure enough, Jim Carrey's name was on the on the list of people to. So if indeed he auditioned, it's the only role I ever beat him out for. but I'll certainly take it. Anyway, yeah, I remember auditioning because it was kind of unusual. As I recall, I only went in once. Phil Robinson was there for the, I went in to meet with just Marjorie, who then had me back for a call back with Phil. But,
right.
You know, usually for a movie like that, you would have, you know, more than just a single callback. But
yeah.
They didn't get back to me for, gosh, many, many weeks. And I was pretty sure that it was
gone.
Yeah. But I'm naturally very, very excited when they said I got the part. So.
And was that, looking back on your career, was that one of your first big studio movies?
Gosh, I mean, I've been acting for 6 years. When I first arrived, I was in The Thornbirds, which was a really big miniseries. It was television, but it was a big project, and had done several other things. I guess it really wasn't a studio picture. So,
right.
So it wasn't, it was such a small part that I really at the time didn't, I was very excited to be in Shoeless Joe, but I didn't think it was going to turn into anything. It was such a beautiful little script that we all just wanted to do it. It was one of those projects you do because you love it. And, I certainly didn't make any money, but, I didn't think it was going to be very successful either. Cause it, had no sex or violence or love story or,
right.
Baseball movies were a pariah at the time. So there was no reason to expect it to do well.
What was the name of your book again? I just want to make sure we hear that.
Yeah, it's called If You Build It.
If You Build It. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you said small part, but like, is that what you thought on the page? Because certainly you look at the movie now today and it holds up just as well as it did, 20 years ago or however long. Your role is certainly not a small role in the story. I mean, and maybe it's just because every single piece of that puzzle of the movie just fits perfectly. Like there's no wasted fat. There's no, every scene so pivotal in taking you through the story.
Yeah. I mean, you asked about my memories. When I got the call to read for John Kinsella, I remember thinking, gosh, I wish I could audition for a bigger part.
Yeah. Yeah.
But part of the reason for that is if you've read the novella, John Kinsella appears in chapter one and throughout the movie, he just has little snippets of conversation with Ray.
Right.
And it's not pivotal at all.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why, I mean, it's kind of stupid of me, but when we were shooting it, I really didn't think it was a big deal. I thought it was sort of the last loose end of the movie. Ray meets his father and,
Wow. Yeah.
I was as surprised as anybody when we had the cast and crew screening the day before it was released, and I realized what Phil had done by moving the introduction of the father to the end.
Right.
It becomes this climactic and an iconic moment of a father and son getting reacquainted, and it was as much a surprise to me as to anybody, and I think I was not the only one in the room. James Horner's score was so haunting and beautiful. I think that did a lot to kind of build the emotion to that final moment. And, by then I was just shocked. We were all shocked. We were all crying, watching ourselves on screen.
Right.
And realizing that we had created something, bigger than we had anticipated.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at it, I think everybody can always argue and debate, but I would say that my personal opinion, it's definitely either number one or number two of the greatest sports movies ever made. I mean, it's better than Hoosiers in my opinion. Maybe Slapshot in a sort of a different category,
Well,
and Paul Newman,
From your perspective too,
hockey
player. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, and I think there's something about that movie, and I think a lot of those movies from the 80s don't really hold up, and I'm not sure why Field of Dreams does. I've talked to parents who are just introducing it to their kids and the kids are like, maybe 5 or 8 or 10 years old. And I'm thinking like, wow, this is a slow movie by today's standards. And, they almost, you know, to a person tell me that the kids just really get into it. They follow the story. They, you know, I think one of the great things about the book that Phil took advantage was it's a little bit of a mystery because, you know, Ray hears this voice and then he has to go on this trip. And if you suspend your disbelief and go on the ride with Ray, you are drawn into the story. You sort of can't help but be drawn in by, you know, meeting Terrence Mann, and Terrence Mann, you know, is so gruff at the beginning, and you're like, what's going to happen with this? And then let's go meet Moonlight Graham and Doc Graham up in Chisholm. And, when you commit to that kind of adventure, the payoff becomes that much more, you know, profound. And I think that's another reason why that final moment. And when I finally appear and nobody is expecting at that point, we sort of think that, well, Terrence Mann's going to go right. You know, Moonlight Graham got the bat, and, you know, we don't think that if you build it, he will come means the father. We thought from the beginning that it meant Shoeless Joe.
Right. I wanted to ask you, I had a good question. Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you this because, and you don't have to be specific, but, so I'm in this movie, a movie called Tenet, which Christopher Nolan made, and it came out, I believe probably a year ago. It was a big movie, right? And I just recently got it was a huge movie. I mean, I think it was maybe, some people say it's one of the most expensive movies ever made in a certain category. Like I think they spent easily $600 million on this movie.
Wow.
I just got my first residual check. And I'm in it. I have three lines in the movie. Okay. I'm blown away. Like, I can't believe how much money it was. It was over $10,000, right?
Wow.
This movie's only been out a year, and I had three lines in the movie. Like, you guys all ended up, you've made money on this movie over, you know, sort of like a surprise over the last 20 years. Like, it just kind of trickles in, right?
Yeah. In my case, it's much more of a trickle. I mean, I think I made $1,400 when I was shooting it.
Right.
You know, I was, you know, essentially a nobody. And so the way residuals work, of course, is you make, you know, a percentage of, you know, like if $1,400 is what they paid me the first time out of a $14 million budget, I'm getting, you know, one thousandth of a, you know, of whatever money comes in. So, I mean, I have certainly gotten a lot of residual checks, and particularly, you know, the first one, like you're saying, the first and second and third ones are more substantial for sure. But, you know, I get checks now from Field of Dreams for, you know, 27 cents or, you know, over the years, I don't know how much I've made, but, you know, I was getting scale.
Right.
So, you know, I think it was $1,400, my first check.
But you know, what's also interesting that I think about these residuals is that, when we're gone, those residuals are going to go to somebody, right?
Yeah.
Like our children or, you know, whoever we decide to leave. Like, it's just an interesting, not when you think about it from a money standpoint, but from a generational standpoint, how these movies sort of live on and they kind of move and they just keep affecting people.
Yeah.
In some way.
Yeah. It's pretty great. And I hope I didn't sound ungrateful for residuals.
Not at all.
I mean, it's really awesome. And I think any plumber or carpenter out there would love to get checks for the rest of their lives for a nail they drove 30 years ago.
Right.
But, you know, because of the kind of fragmentation of the media market these days, residuals are not generally what there used to be. I'm a little bit surprised that you had such a nice check. You know, there used to be a bar in North Hollywood called Residuals back in the 80s. And the gig was that if you got a residual check for less than a buck, for less than a dollar, you could go in there and get a free drink. And they would put the,
oh, you know, my
pin,
God.
They would pin the check to the wall. And it was kind of, it was kind of a joke, you know, but what happened is when, you know, cable came out and then kind of spun off and all these things, there were so many of them, the bar literally went out of business because, you know, everybody, I get 10 checks a week that are under a dollar. So,
Oh, that's funny. It would have put them out of business.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's such a funny, that's a funny idea. What a, man, the '80s were, and I remember what I was going to say. So we talk about movies from the '80s, like The Big Chill to me is my number one movie. I think it's the greatest movie ever made.
Wow, that's a great movie.
And, you know, it's funny because Kevin was a story was with him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And he never ended up in the film, which is one of those just amazing movie stories. But they just can't make movies like that anymore. Why? And you know, I guess it's frustrating. Right. Even from a color and just from a pacing, like you've been in the business a long time. You've seen the evolution. Do you think it'll ever find its way back?
Gosh, I don't know. I sort of doubt it. I mean, there was that heyday of the, you know, in the late '80s when there were, there were so many independent films being made and, you know, and so many places that would then, you know, pick them up and distribute them.
Yeah.
And now it seems to me because of all the, because of all the, you know, kind of comic book movies, if it's not a movie that's going to make, if it's going to gross $500 million worldwide, people just don't want to mess with it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it says something about, you know, the state of our greed or our, you know, that there's a certain amount of money that, you know, if they made more movies like Big Chill and Field of Dreams, I would, I'd still be acting. I think it's just, I just don't love those big blockbusters.
Listen, you know, you just said it right there. I mean, you've been in the business a long time. Like, what gets you excited? Right. And even when you, take, you know, like Riverdale, I mean, do you really want to play a dad or a grandfather on Riverdale or whatever? You know what I mean? Or even flashbacks, like when you've been in and you've seen and you know and you remember the quality of like what it used to be, because it just used to be so good. I mean, I was born in 1980. So, you know, now when I look back on movies from the 80s, like, all my favorites are from there, you know?
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I was auditioning for things I didn't even want. And after I did that for a while, I just thought, what am I doing?
You
know, if I don't even want the part, you know, why should I, you know, why am I doing it? And, you know, I don't know. We could get into this, but
I
told myself I'd get out of the business before I got bitter, because I think, you know, it can happen. You know, it's just tough business, you know, but, I think I succeeded in getting out when I still had a love for, storytelling and all that stuff.
How did you memorize your lines? What was like, were you born with great memorization or was it something you had to work at?
No, I really don't have a very good memory, but I started out in the theater and, you know, when you have to learn a whole play, you know, an hour and a half worth of dialogue and you know, 7-page monologues, you know, learning the 5 pages I had to do in Field of Dreams was easy, but it was not something that I was ever very good at, in my opinion.
Right.
You know, I did it, but, and it's a skill like anything else. You know, how do you shoot a slap shot? Well, you do it 10,000 times and you start to get it down, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't have any tricks, I'm afraid. I mean, you know, I would do all the things, you know, put the other person's lines on a tape recorder and, you know, all those things, but none of it was,
you just have to get it into your head somehow. Right.
Yeah. And if understand. You have to go out there go out there once and forget your lines and the next time you're inclined to, work a little harder.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Are you on Cameo?
I am.
Oh, you are. Okay. So is this recently or, cause I got to think now with all the, like, I'm on Cameo. I've done over 4,000. I love Cameo. But it seems like you're probably, is business picking up a little bit now?
Oh, a little bit. I have a love-hate relationship with Cameo. But you know, I sort of do it for the fans. You know, I like you know, I like making myself available for fans. I do a lot of stuff just because, you know, I love that movie as much as the fans do. And right. so, but, I take it a little too, seriously and, cause I want to make it perfect for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I sometimes need a break from it cause I get burned out a little.
Yeah. Honestly, I'll tell you, like, I think, and that's the professional in you, people are just so happy to see it. You know what I mean? That I think the looser and, you know, you just make them fun. But, you also had this, you were really like had a hell of a look, right? Like, did you do, like, I feel like you could have been the Marlboro man in your younger days.
But well, I appreciate that.
Did you do modeling stuff or?
I mean, I tried several things. I tried modeling, but I just didn't think I was very good at it. Yeah. I did one modeling job and it was kind of a group shot where I was, you know, I was a guy in a construction hat or something. Right. I appreciate what you say, but I think I have a kind of, I'm just off enough that it doesn't work for, modeling. And, you know, it was never something that interested me that much anyway. And,
it's almost like I guess the reason I said that is like, even our men, you know, from the 80s, like you guys just had this look, you know what I mean? That I just feel like today, and I know I'm shitting on today a lot, but like, I don't know, we're losing it. We're losing that manly, you know, gruff and being able to be a man, but that's just me going on.
Yeah, I think things definitely change. You know, I think like, for instance, Napoleon Dynamite, which is a movie that I love.
Yep.
But that and amongst, you know, even Revenge of the Nerds but it kind of made leading men a little bit obsolete.
Right.
I've actually, as much as it hurt my career, I'm kind of grateful that a lot of the people who don't have the, you know, aren't born with the genes that, you know, give them a certain look, you know, that they're getting their chance. But it has changed the whole complexion of the business. And, you know, like I said, I think in the larger scale of things, it's a good thing, just the way, you know, kind of colorblind casting is a good thing. It's certainly not helping me, but
right.
I think in the larger scheme of things, I would not have wanted to be somebody who, you know, never got the part because I wasn't, you know, quite good looking enough or wasn't, you know, anyway. So,
what last question, who is the best actor that you actor? And I say actor as in actress and actor, same thing. Who's the best?
Oh boy.
Just that you were, you know, really like, and it, listen, this could be anybody. I'm not saying it was the biggest star, but
yeah. Well, there's people, you know, I went to see John Malkovich in plays in Chicago when I was just starting out.
Yeah.
And he was certainly, you know, he's just so weird and quirky and fun to watch. And I mean, I always loved Robert Duvall.
Yeah.
You know, to pick a favorite is pretty difficult. I mean, Meryl Streep, it's hard to argue. I mean, she does what she does better than anybody else I can think of. And I mean, you know, Maggie Smith is hilarious Kate Winslet. I love Kate Winslet. Yeah. She's somebody who brings a kind of an earthy organic feeling to everything she does. So
yeah, there's a,
it's hard to pick just one.
There's a texture to all those names. Like you could almost reach out and touch them. Like they just have the substance to them, you know?
Right. I wasn't a huge fan of Joaquin Phoenix Once Upon a Time, but it really, he acts like he doesn't care what people think. And I think that is refreshing to watch.
It is. So, I think for everyone out there, I think we should all not care what people think a little more, you know, and kind of blaze your own path. But
yeah, totally.
Dwyer, I really appreciate you taking the time. Really. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Sean. Thanks for having me on. It's great. I don't often get to talk show business with somebody who's, you know, has gotten their foot in the water too. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. Yeah. Well, If You Build It is your book. You're on Cameo, even though you don't like it, but don't worry.
I don't want to say I don't like it. Yeah.
Dwyer Brown, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, Sean.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. Field of Dreams doesn't get much better than that. I'll tell you that right now. All right. Do yourself a favor. If you haven't seen the movie, The Big Chill, watch that. All right. Episode 86, No Gruffs Given. Let's move on to my conversation with Jen.
Hello.
Hey, Jen.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good.
I know the backstory. Everybody else doesn't know the backstory. Will you walk me through it?
Yeah, sure. Just basically, I'm here in Denver. I was headed home from a friend's house who lives on the east side of town. I live on the west side of town. So Colfax is a major like street that goes east-west down through downtown Denver. So I was driving down Colfax, and it was the first night of the George Floyd riots.
Yeah.
And didn't know the protest was going on. And all of a sudden, you know, came over this hill, came upon a crowd of people, knew immediately that it was, a protest.
Yeah.
And basically didn't really want to be there, didn't want to be a part of it. I was fortunately, had kind of just come upon it where in front of me, ahead of me, the traffic was all stopped.
Yeah.
So a lot of cars were kind of screwed, if you will, like they're stuck like in between other cars, all the people. So I'm in a position where I kind of still have an opportunity to try and avoid it.
Yeah.
So I follow some other cars in front of me and try and veer off south down Broadway where there aren't as many people so I can get home. And I was immediately met by, a wall of people kind of that came and stood in front of my car.
Yeah.
Probably 9 or 10 people. If you watch the Halo videos, then you can just see like this mob of people then like running towards my car. So that group immediately turned much larger. And of course, it's just pure chaos down there.
Yeah.
The police weren't prepared. This wasn't a permitted protest. It wasn't controlled. So these protesters, are screaming, yelling, surrounding my car. I have my dog in the front seat. And, he's always riding shotgun. He was chilling, fine, whatever. Well, then when we started getting surrounded and people are, banging on the windows, banging on the sides of the car.
Yeah.
Dog starts barking, like attack mode, like someone comes to the door, dog starts barking. So he's doing that. So I'm like, I have my window down. I'm getting kind of anxious, but I'm like, just trying to tell them. I'm like, I'm on your side. I didn't do this. I didn't kill anybody. I'm just trying to go home.
Yeah.
I just want to go home. And of course, they didn't want to hear it. So they all start flipping me off. And this becomes a big thing later on in trial, but they all start flipping me off. So I like flip them back off.
Yeah.
And then they got really mad and started kicking my car, hitting it. This one guy, a guy from the side smashes his fist on the windshield. It cracks. And this other guy jumps up onto the hood of my car. Mind you, I'm at a dead stop. Jumps up onto the hood of my car and starts smashing, like punching my windshield. And of course, at the time, I'm like, I don't know if he has like, brass knuckles, a brick, I don't know [S2] Yeah. [S1] What he has in his hand. I didn't know you could just smash a windshield out with your bare fist. So he's, punching in my windshield. So then it was just pure terror, pure panic. My dog starts like convulsing at that minute, like goes into this, pure panic, panting, cowers down. So, and at this moment, and I'm talking to my boyfriend on the phone at the time, and I'm like giving him the play-by-play, and I'm like, oh, the protest, and oh my God, they're surrounding me. Oh my God, they're like hitting my car. Oh my God, he's on my car. He's on my car. He's punching my windshield. And my boyfriend's like, call the cops. And I'm like, the cops are down here. And he's like, well, then get out.
Yeah.
So I'm like, go. So as soon as he starts smashing my windshield, I don't know how much further they're going to take it. So I just freak out and I go.
Yeah.
And when he, jumps off my car, we're both like, he jumps off. My car is headed in a right turn direction. I'm like, go. So like press on the gas. My car goes right. He's running to the right. My car makes contact with him. He like gets bumped over, jumps up, showboating,
yeah.
Starts running after me. And meanwhile, another chick grabs onto my passenger window that was cracked a little bit for my dog, jumps on, holds onto my car. So it's like, this video goes viral, but nobody sees. All you see is this like, 5 second clip
where
my car touches Max Bailey. Like nobody's showing that there's still protesters to the left of me, protesters still chasing me, a girl holding onto my car as I'm trying to drive away. So, you know, it was terrifying. And I, you know, at that point I'm like, I just need to get to safety. And, you know, I can't see out of like the right hand side of my windshield. It's all cracked, smashed into pieces. So I just book it. And as soon as I get home, I call 911 and they tell me that they're too busy dealing with the protests to like come out.
Right.
Asking if I'm physically okay. You know, yeah, physically, I'm shaken, but I'm okay. My car is damaged, but physically I'm okay.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, I'm not going to worry about it. But it was, you know, 30 minutes later, maybe that Twitter video just went viral. And I literally said to my neighbor who was out there, found it. And I was like, that is not what just happened. Like, he's like, oh, I know. I can see your car. I know that's not what happened. I'm like, that's not what happened.
Right.
And so that's when I knew that I would need an attorney. And yeah, it got pretty bad.
So how long after did they charge you?
So the DPD, first of all, within about 10 hours after it went viral, Antifa had doxed me, got my license plate from the video, and had put out, you know, my name, my full name, my address, my phone number. So within hours, my phone, like, as soon as it got leaked, I couldn't even pick up my phone. The calls were coming in so fast.
Yeah.
Like calls, death threats, pictures of my house. You know, and meanwhile, this kid, Max Bailey, who had smashed in my window, you know, he went back out and protested all the rest of the night and the next day.
Yeah.
And then after he realized that social was kind of spinning him as this victim, that's when he decided to go. This was well over 24 hours later. He decides to go down to the police station and file a report against me. And that's when the DPD actually started, like, you know, kind of investigating it. They didn't actually come out to my house and take pictures of my car and all that until some protesters showed up at my house. So this all happened on a Thursday. On Monday, I went into the police station and gave a statement. When I left the police station, their protesters showed up at my house, hung signs up saying like, fuck this bitch, this is the killer bitch, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So that's the first time the DPD came out to my house, was to photograph the signs. That's the first time they looked at my car.
So the first time you went in for the statement, did they call you or did you voluntarily, like, did you call them and say, hey, I'm here? Or how did
through my attorney. So again, Thursday night, I realized I need an attorney.
Oh, okay.
Got an attorney. Friday, he called the DPD. You know, he's like, the news is out here saying they're looking for this driver, but she called you guys last night.
Right.
She reported the incident. You know, she'll come down. We'll come down. So he kind of orchestrated it.
Okay. So then they come out and see you on the Sunday or the Monday.
I go see them Monday. Then they come to my house and take photos.
All right. Then what happens?
So at that point, Max Bailey had gone down to file, file charges against me or whatever after he saw the media spinning it. Well, so now I go in and give a statement and now they're trying to get him back in. And they can't get him to come in. They have like 3 appointments with him. He doesn't show up. Meanwhile, he consults with Frank Azar, which is like a local injury attorney. You know?
Of course. Yeah.
Who then refers him to one of his doctors.
Oh, yeah.
So then Max Bailey goes in to see the doctor, which he didn't really have injuries, but still took it to my insurance, sued me civilly, got paid out somewhere around 50 grand. You know, and this is all before he even goes back into the police department. So the police, you know, they didn't, my understanding kind of from what they were telling me and the lack of him kind of showing up was that they're like, there's no way there can be charges pressed in this case. There's just like, no way. They saw my car.
Yeah.
All of that. So they hand it over to the DA and the DA, Beth McCann, sits on it for like 4 weeks, I think it was, until she starts, the media comes back out wanting to know what happened to this driver, you know, who hit the guy. And so she starts getting all this like media pressure. So then she calls my attorney within like 10 hours of that and says she's charging me with a felony assault charge with a deadly weapon.
What was her name?
Beth McCann.
Beth McCann. Okay. All right. So then what happens?
So she's going to charge me with a felony. And at that point, my attorney's like, what my attorney used to work in the DA's office. So he knows her. He used to work with her. He knows people in that department. So he calls them and, you know, he's like, how could you press felony charges? This is insane. Like, what about the police officer that was following her down Broadway? Well, the chick was holding onto her car. Did you get his statement? Oh no, we didn't get that. Well, did you listen to her 911 call? Oh no, we didn't know there was a 911 call. Like, just crazy. It's like they didn't even look at the case.
Yeah.
So then they kind of, he sends them a bunch of that stuff. And then they're like, oh, okay. So then they come back and decide to charge me with a misdemeanor felony, or I'm sorry, a misdemeanor with a deadly weapon, assault with a deadly weapon misdemeanor.
Yeah.
These
fucking cowards. Like, so, all right, we're not going to charge her with a felony, but we need to charge her with something because we're fucking cowards. All right. Yeah. So then what happens?
Yes, exactly. It's so crazy. You know, I mean, and meanwhile, she goes to consult with Max Bailey to see if he thinks that's like, if he'll be appeased with that charge against me.
Yeah.
Like, it's up to him. Like, we wouldn't be in this position. I mean, it's not just him. This was not a peaceful protest. There were many people involved, but he's the one that really crossed it over the line for me. Like, that's when it went from like, anxiety to like pure fear.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we wouldn't be in this position if not for him, but he gets nothing.
So are these charges like current?
So I just finished trial. I had a 3-day, well, 2.5-day trial.
You're
on
kidding.
July 7th.
they actually took this to trial because
took it to trial.
So they tried to offer you some plea or something. You guys said no or whatever, but you end up in trial.
Yeah, they really didn't offer me. They talked with my attorney a little bit about this is what we're thinking we might do.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't have taken it anyways, but okay.
And I would not have taken it.
All right.
One of the things they had mentioned was restorative justice, where they basically want me to go into a room full of people with Max Bailey and apologize to him. Like, yeah. You know, bend over and apologize to him for what I've done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's no way.
Yeah, they are fucking, they are scum. All right, so you go to trial. What happens?
Well, so we go to trial. So Beth McCann, first of all, makes this decision after the media pressure, right? And obviously this is a very heated time, you know, right off George Floyd.
Yeah. Who gives a fuck? That has nothing to do with you or you being a fucking American citizen and wanting to just be protected under the law. But anyways, yeah.
Yeah, it shouldn't, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, just so many things. Like, she didn't look at the case, comes at these charges. They don't really do a plea deal. Again, I wouldn't have taken it anyways, but we go to trial and, you know, so many things. I don't know. So many things. So first of all, Max Bailey comes in to testify. Never once do they like ask him directly, like, did you do this? Did you? And he just sat there and talked. He's a model and he's like trying up his modeling career and he likes to talk about himself. And
yeah.
And he talked about, they asked him what he was doing before the protest. And he's like a pretty jacked dude. Like, he obviously like works out.
Yeah.
And they asked him what he was doing before the protest. And he's literally says that he was out practicing boxing with his buddies, you know, and then comes and smashes my windshield.
Yeah.
I had a crash reconstruction guy there talking about how my car was already like turning in that direction. I mean, I really didn't even know I hit anything. I mean, I barely hit him. I didn't even know. And people could be like, how could you not know? Well, because when you're getting your car karate kicked, at some point the line is crossed between like, you don't know what is hitting you or what you're hitting. You're just trying to get out of there.
Okay. So what happened?
So the jury, well, and I had full intentions of testifying.
Yeah.
Because I don't have like some story, like, I had full intentions of testifying until the DA's office started making their case that I went home and smashed in my own windshield because, you know, the cops, I had 4 days between the incident and when the cops photographed it. So technically I could have smashed in my own windshield.
Yeah.
So their case was that. And also Beth McCann's office told my attorney that the reason they came to, you know, found charges against me is because I had used my middle finger and that shows that I'm like an angry person and I was just down there to do harm.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
So their whole case is that I smashed my own windshield and that I used my middle finger. So, I mean, at that point, it was like, I just, I didn't know what else they were going to come up with or fabricate or whatever.
Right.
So we decided at that point it was best if I didn't take the stand. But by not taking the stand, then the jury still never hears my 911 call. They never see the photos that I took from inside my car. You know, we sat in trial for 2 days and watched one video over and over that a bystander took from the sidewalk with a view completely that was not mine.
Okay. So,
you know,
yeah, this is making me nervous. Okay. So what happened?
So the jury goes into like a 6.5 hour deliberation.
And by the way, the fact that they fucking spent money on a jury to sit in there for 2 days is fucking criminal all in itself. But that's fine. Okay, so these fucking jurors go in and do what?
Wait, no, I agree with you. I'm like, this is seriously the judge's time, the court's time.
No, it's
time,
crazy.
The VA's time.
It's fucking crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. You know, and so the jury, as soon as they went past about 2 hours, I knew for sure there was a hang up somewhere. But again, I still don't even feel like the jury even heard the case.
Yeah.
Like they didn't even hear from my side. I don't know. Frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, the jury, as soon as they took more than 2 hours, I knew for sure that they were going to, because there were two charges, I knew at that point they were going to compromise. Like I just knew it. So thank God they came back with not guilty of assault and they found me guilty of reckless driving. But then, which is still a misdemeanor. And then, so we're talking about, so the judge at that point is like, here, you know, me, my friends, family, we've all been sitting in this courtroom for 3 days now. And she's like, should we go right into sentencing? And the DA's, her little DA guys stand up and they're like, no, we don't believe that's fair because Max Bailey has the right to come in and give his victim statement. And
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
So she literally pushed sentencing out 2 weeks so that Max Bailey had the opportunity to come in and give a victim statement. And of course, my attorney's like, she was just found not guilty of assault. How is he still being played the victim here?
Yeah.
And so sure enough, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, we all end up back in the courtroom again. And is Max Bailey there? No. You know?
He didn't show up?
Didn't show up.
All right. So what did they sentence you?
So they gave me 8 points on my license, like a fine of like 400, which is like a penny in the bucket compared to what I've spent on this. But,
yeah.
And then 48 hours of community service.
Okay. Why the fuck did you guys not appeal this?
So here's the other thing. I want to appeal it. And in talking, you know, with my attorney, you know, he's telling me like, you can appeal it. I'll give you the name of an appellate lawyer. But the thing is, it just goes back into the same courthouse to the judges that share the, you know, break room with Carrie Lombardi, the judge.
It doesn't matter. It's a new jury.
Well, it wouldn't be. I don't think it would be a new jury. I think it was for the reckless driving charge. I think it's just a judge that like reviews the case.
Oh, an appeals judge.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, why don't we crowdfund and get you the money so that you can appeal and it's worth the shot. I mean,
I agree with you. I'm not like, I do.
Because this is a fucking, because let me just, first of all, go on the record that this happened to me a few times in New York, probably 4 times. All right. It happened to me in New York. 2 of the 4 times it happened, it was with groups of like less than 6 to 8 people. And one of the times I got out and I fought one of the kids and I fucked him up like, and no
good.
One, and it was, I don't know how I drove home and I was like, this is going to be on TMZ in 20 minutes. No one ever found, I don't know if like I scared everyone enough that they didn't get their phones out or what, but I fucked up one of these kids bad. There were two or three times where it happened where there was like, I don't know, 20 of them, like fucking 20 of them. And they took my, they took the cover off of the wheel on the back of the SUV. They smashed that off with a skateboard. Like they fucked the car up. Okay. Anytime that this has happened and we've seen this happen and I've seen the videos, if a fucking angry mob attacks somebody in a car, whether it's me or you or whoever it is, How in the fucking right mind does the justice system think that you're not allowed to just like fucking run them over? Run them fucking over. I mean, and don't say anything. I don't want you to say anything because I don't want this to be used against you. All right. So you don't even have to, I don't want you to answer that. This is me saying that. This is a fucking travesty. Okay. And this Beth McCann, first of all, this Max Bailey, is he on like social media? Does this kid like, is he like living his life trying to be famous?
Oh yeah. He's like out there talking all the news, you know, he's just totally used it as his like fame.
Yeah.
You know, and then he got paid.
Did you ever find out, is he a part of any sort of like, is he Antifa or he's just a bozo that like wanted to go out and cause some trouble with his friends?
Yeah. He literally said in trial that he was going to stand in front of my car at no matter what the cost.
Do you have the videos from your trial?
Yeah, I have everything. I mean, I've got all the things.
Yeah. Will you email it to me?
Yeah.
I think that you need to start some sort of a GoFundMe or like, do you have it started yet?
Yeah, I did. I did a GoFundMe just to help with the like attorney fees, which I think I raised enough money to pay like half. And believe me, I'm not the type of person to want to like ask for money, but I'm also wasn't planning for like, you know, 20 grand. And my attorney was very fair with me right off the bat. He didn't think it was going anywhere. He's like, this will be over in a week. And well, here we are a year, three months later.
Well, he's a fucking idiot. And I'm sorry to say it because I've just spent 10 minutes with you on the phone. Actually 21, felt like 10. You should have been on the stand. Like there is no question that those jurors should have heard your voice talking about the terror and your dog. And, you know, they should have fucking heard your voice. That is 101. Like how he made that decision blows my mind. You're his most valuable asset. You're your own most valuable asset in that situation. Lawyers are so stupid and they're fucking cowards. They're all a bunch of chicken shits.
Well, yeah, my dad would say the same thing. I'll tell you that.
I mean,
but I do. I regret not going there. But the problem was the DA is throwing this. You did your own windshield. And you know what else are they going to come up with? And I think after talking to me, like I'm not someone to just cower down. So
yeah, that doesn't matter. You can still, I know that's the typical thing. That's what they try and pull. But like,
yeah, they make you angry, which is what they were trying to make me out to be angry. What they wanted to do.
And by the way, you know, anger, fear, panic, like all of those fucking things fall in the same bucket when you've got somebody standing on top of your car, smashing your fucking windshield in while there's people surrounding you. No, I'm saying this because I'm telling you, any of us listening right now that are in Canada or in the US, this could happen to us. Like, and it's not over. All right.
No. Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
And the fucking cops, and I don't even know if I blame the cops or who to blame, but like, where's the compassion and where are the guidelines and where are our politicians? Why aren't they changing rules to say that if your car is attacked by a mob of people, you have every right to drive away. Like you don't need to stand there and get killed and hope they don't kill you so that, you know, you dodged a bullet by driving away and running over one of these fucking shitbags. It's unbelievable.
Imagine?
It's unbelievable.
God. Like that chick holding on to my car as I'm driving. Thank God she didn't fall. I mean,
yeah, your life would have been fucking. Yeah,
thank God she didn't fall.
I mean, you'd be in jail. Yeah.
And I didn't. I mean, I was almost facing a felony charge. No one was even hurt. No, I was the only one that left with damage.
I want you to honestly, and you don't need to decide right now because we can revisit it next week. I want you to put some thought into this because I'm telling you right now, I will put money into this. If people that are listening, you put a fucking dollar, $1 and hope that if you were in your situation, Jen, that we would have people that would come out and support. This can ruin your life financially.
It did ruin my life. It already ruined my life. And that's what my mom got up and said to the judge's sentencing. you know, at least whatever sentence you give her will come to an end. Whereas the sentence she has already paid will last a lifetime.
Yeah.
Like, I sent you my name. You can't even look me up. I had to take a new job and I don't even, he said he knows what happened and he gave me a job, but I have to use a different last name. Like, it's
yeah,
so
it's
crazy.
Fucking nuts. It's fucking nuts. All right. I want you to think about this and we can talk like offline. You got to talk to your parents and stuff, but your lawyer fucked up. Okay. If you live in the Denver area, pick up the phone and call Beth McCann's office. Start making some noise in the other direction. Okay. Start making.
Absolutely. I'm, you know, a lot of my friends and family are like, why are you still doing this? Like, at least it's over. I'm like, no,
fuck that. Are you kidding me?
It's not over.
Yeah,
like, this has literally destroyed my life and people need to know about Beth McCann and Carrie Lombardi. The judge was no better.
No, Carrie Lombardi. There you go.
At sentencing, first of all, when she gave Max Bailey the right to come back in and give a victim statement, she also told me that I must be arrogant for not wanting to wait in traffic. And she asked me why I had never apologized to Max Bailey.
Yeah,
I'm like, for what?
These people are cowards. You know the level, and this is what I always say. I'm like, who are their families? You know what I mean? Because
totally.
I haven't been lucky enough to have somebody in my family that is this much of a monster that I could fucking torture, that I could torment every time I see them and tell them and remind them how much of a spineless coward they are. Okay. I'm not lucky enough to know any of these fucking people, but they need to be exposed and they are cowards. They are cowards that didn't want the political woke mob to come at them at a time where you can't do anything. It's all the same fucking shit. So Beth McCann is the district attorney.
Yep.
And the judge is, what's her name one more time?
Carrie Lombardi.
Carrie Lombardi. Because I want to tell you one other thing, Jen. And this is what the average person doesn't, they don't have this fight, but I can tell you have it, is we are living in a world now where you need to fight fire with fire. Okay. So as much noise as they make, it's now time for other people, us, to make noise directly at this judge and this district attorney. And, you know, I don't know what you're going to decide. I want you to think about this because I don't think you should. I think that if I could say to you, listen, I don't know, we might be able to raise like $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 pretty quick. Like, with maybe that makes the decision easier for you. I don't know.
To go appeal it? I would love to appeal it. I mean, I would love to appeal it.
Well, think about it and we'll talk.
And if anybody knows a good appeals lawyer, then let's talk.
In Denver, maybe somebody knows one and they want to help. Cause this is fucking criminal, you know, and this is the climate that we're living in. And the only way that this is going to go away is if we collectively band together and fight back, because it's not going to stop. It's not going to stop.
It's not. And I've thankfully never had to be in this position before, but you do not realize how powerless you are against these DAs and judges until you're in it. It's scary. I mean, they literally could have sent me to jail for doing nothing, for trying to protect myself.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. I know. Okay. Let's talk in a couple of days, Jen. Thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Episode 86, No Gruffs Given. Another week, another dollar. Another week, another dollop. All right. What can we control? We can control our own destiny by staying positive, working hard. We don't lie, steal, or cheat. We get after it. We put our foot on the gas. We clear our mechanism. We get our elbows up. All right. That's how we stay on the Look Good, Feel Good program. We pound the pavement. We get our miles in. Every single day, we make ourselves feel uncomfortable. And I'll tell you, I'm uncomfortable when I don't get cameos because I need you, ladies and gentlemen, to support the cause. Otherwise, I just got to pull the plug. The juice ain't worth the squeeze. You know, we can't be time vampires, content vampires. You gotta give Sean a little pat on the back every once in a while. And the best way to do that is by booking a cameo. And again, I'll just remind you, it's not like an NFT. You get a real video that you're going to be able to laugh at for years to come. Like, imagine if you buy somebody a Cameo every year from now until I die on their birthday, we're going to have all these Cameo videos for years down the road. It's genius. Cameo is my favorite company. Episode 86. No gruffs given. I want you to listen to this song.
Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, what have I done? I've fallen in love with a man on the run. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, I'm begging you, please, don't take that sinner from me. Oh, don't take that sinner from me. Oh, Lord, oh, falling for someone who's nothing like you. He's raised on the edge of the devil's backbone. Oh, I just wanna take him on. Oh, I just wanna take him on. Sinner.